I'm Steve Hatton. This is number 0875, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0875. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Elizabeth Margulis, who is the author of Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams.
There's nothing in the book, Transported, that is going to explain away or make less interesting any of your musical experiences. It's absolutely intended, and I think does, make us more curious about them, help us see what can be learned and discovered by paying attention to them and talking about them and sharing them with others. So the response that I've tended to get is, you know, I'll never listen to music the same way again, but in a way where it's richer and more interesting, not that it has been flat.
S.A. Schneider is the author of The Bigfoot Case, a fictional children's book that has a real Bigfoot-related character in it.
There's a gentleman by the name of Stan Gordon, a character in the book. He's actually a real person, and he allowed me to fictionalize him for the book. He just said that, you know, make sure everybody knows this is not a real documented report, that this is fiction, because he does take documented reports. He's been doing so since the 60s. He's been on multiple TV shows, multiple books. If you watch any type of shows that have anybody from the Pennsylvania region talking about Bigfoot and UFOs, he's probably in there.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, is here for his monthly visit. This time around, he shares the story of the Hollow Earth cult.
They thought that we were on the surface as we are now, and that was inside of a hollow earth. So the sky itself was part of this sphere that we were living inside, and that the sun was revolving within this sphere, and that the moon was basically like a reflection of something in the middle of the earth, and it wasn't actually another celestial body out there, and that this sphere, with the sky being at like the surrounding top of the sphere, was it. So about 25,000 miles in circumference, so about 8,000 miles across, that was the universe. There was nothing outside of it.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0875, was Steve Hatton, a freelance writer who operates the Facebook page TV Montreal Media Fun Group. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Remember Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines? That's not only a great action film, it's a documentary.
Imagine a world of permanent darkness, where machines control man's destiny. But before you do, something terrible has to happen.
And the Rise of the Machines starts off very simple. Case in point, dozens of empty self-driving Waymo vehicles have been flooding into Atlanta's Battleview Drive cul-de-sacs, alarming residents who report up to 50 cars arriving between 6 and 7 a.m.
This can't be happening.
The robo-taxis began appearing months ago, but increased dramatically in recent weeks, circling dead-end residential streets without passengers.
Are you going to kill me?
No. My mission is to protect you.
Neighbors attempted using signs to deter the vehicles, which caused them to get stuck while turning around.
TX has corrupted my system.
The machines, they're starting to take over.
Residents expressed safety concerns for children and pets in the quiet neighborhood, Said one neighbor,
"We're families, we have small kids, we have animals and pets, we've got kids getting on the bus in the mornings, and it just doesn't feel safe to have that traffic. We would just like to see them stay on main traffic roads. I don't think there's any reason to be on small residential cul-de-sacs if they're not picking up somebody."
Waymo acknowledged the issue, stating they take community feedback seriously and have already addressed this routing behavior. The company emphasized their commitment to being good neighbors while highlighting their 500,000 weekly trips nationwide. Yep, this is how it begins.
Say hello to Waymo.
Desire is irrelevant. I am a machine.
Alberta RCMP officers responded to a theft report involving barbecue goods in Crow's Nest Pass on May 18th and discovered an unusual suspect. Police were searching for someone described as having red hair, short stature, and wearing a thick coat. After a brief investigation, officers found a red fox attempting to hide nearby with its mouth stuffed full of stolen hot dogs. The RCMP shared photos on social media showing the thieving fox caught with the evidence. Said officials who wrote in their humorous social media post about the incident, the suspect was released without conditions and a full belly. The fox was allowed to keep its pilfered meal. I don't know. You know, serious Canadian barbecuers like myself, who actually barbecue year-round, regardless of the weather, can be both innovative and spiteful. Humans generally do not eat foxes due to their tough, chewy texture, unappealing flavor, and concerns about parasites, but it doesn't mean they won't. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have a brand new semi-regular segment on the show, which I guess you can say is Idiot of the Day adjacent. There are strict rules that we have for someone to be the Idiot of the Day, so for those who don't quite make the cut, they can still be in this new segment. So, here we go.
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
In Florida, a Lee County driver, Yair Rivera, crashed his Lexus after leading troopers on a high-speed chase, exceeding 130 miles per hour on May 16th. Then asking officers if he should upgrade to a faster vehicle. Yeah. Florida Highway Patrol spotted the car traveling over 100 miles per hour on State Road 82 around 10:30 p.m., weaving aggressively through traffic. When troopers attempted a traffic stop, Rivera accelerated and reached speeds past 130 miles per hour while driving without headlights. Yeah. The chase ended when Rivera lost control, rolling into trees and scattering debris across the area. Rivera was arrested on charges of reckless driving, super speeding, and fleeing law enforcement. According to troopers, Rivera showed no remorse and laughed while asking about getting a faster car for his next attempt. I'm guessing he doesn't have car insurance.
This has been the Stuff File program, asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
And let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Elizabeth Margulis is a professor of music at Princeton University. She also is the author of Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. It's a book showing that music doesn't just accompany our thoughts, it actively shapes them. Dr. Margulis joins us from New Jersey via Riverside.com. Hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for being on the program with us. This sounds fascinating. It's not something that I've ever thought about studying, but you have studied this and have written the book. How did you come to this?
Actually, I was brainwashed growing up as a conservatory-trained classical pianist. I was definitely not somebody going around thinking about where our minds wander when we're listening to music. I was trying to pay all kinds of attention and be really dutiful and focus. And it was really my students who kind of halfway through my career started describing these vivid imaginings they were having while listening that got me really curious and turned my attention to this phenomenon.
The vivid imaginations, is it something that is steeped in memory, like from listening to music that you've listened to before, or can it be something that happens with new music that you're hearing for the first time?
We see this happening not only to pieces of music people have never heard before, but also to music in styles and from cultures that they've never listened to before, too, where just we have these extremely concrete and it turns out broadly shared associations, even to sounds that we've never heard before.
How did this discipline, I guess, come to be? Was it an aha moment? Is this something that people have been studying for a while?
I really love doing research in the cognitive science of music because there's so much about music listening that we take for granted and don't pay attention to that provides such interesting way in to new insights about the human mind. Maybe I'll give another example besides musical daydreams, which is the phenomenon of the earworm, where you get a tune stuck in your head that starts to play and replay. And we tended to kind of like assume that that was our own kind of personal issue until scholarship started studying it and realized that these are incredibly normal, happen to more than 90% of people on a regular basis and actually provide interesting windows into the architecture of human memory. So I view daydreams similarly.
I'm leading now toward the idea of music in movies because there are scores that are done to set the mood of a particular scene in a movie. Are composers aware of what they're doing vis-a-vis transporting their audience through music?
So I look at film composers as savants of musical daydreams, right? The people who have just the deepest, richest expertise in this area. And we've actually seen that we can put people in a brain scanner, look at what's happening when they're watching an entire movie with its soundtrack, and see how brain activity from earlier scenes where a tune had been playing in the soundtrack, how that reactivates when they're watching a later scene with the same song.
The subtitle of your book is The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. To you, what is a musical daydream?
Anytime when you're listening and your attention shifts, you're not focusing on the sound anymore, you're lost in some kind of personal memory, some kind of vivid imagining. I start the book with a really noteworthy cinematic rendering of this, which is the final scene of La La Land, where the character played by Emma Stone wanders into this bar. It turns out her long-lost boyfriend, like she's now happily married and everything. But the character played by Ryan Gosling, you know, sits down at the piano, starts playing this tune that played when they first met. And then we, as the audience, watch everything kind of fade to black. And we're all just kind of reimmersed in this initial encounter, just like the character. So musical daydreams can be incredibly sensorily vivid and feel more like a reliving than like a recollection.
How early does this develop? And the reason why I ask that question is, as you get older, you have memories of music and what they mean to you or what it means to you. But I'm assuming that this is something that can happen to a young child, even when they're hearing music for the first time. So what's the difference between memory and imagination as far as music is concerned?
this is such a great question and something we were really curious about too, because the paradigm we've always used in adults is to play them songs they haven't heard before and just ask them to report to us what they imagined. And then we use cool tools from machine learning to analyze those responses. But we were worried kids might not be able to talk to us as fluently, like their vocabularies aren't sufficiently developed. And so what we did is actually use AI to create little videos of the stories that adults reported to us for particular songs. And then we'd play the kids the song, show them two videos, one of which was the one that adults tended to match the story that adults reported when they heard the song, and ask kids just to pick which of the videos reflected what they imagined. And using that paradigm, we see this response in an adult-like way as early as 4 and 5 in kids. So it seems to be something that comes online extremely early in childhood.
As I mentioned in the introduction, music doesn't just accompany our thoughts, it actively shapes them. So do you think it, especially in a child, do you think it brings their personality out or just merely enhances it?
Right. So, I mean, we know from the very earliest stages that music is social for all of us, but for kids as well. And maybe I'll just give you one example of this. When researchers took two songs that were very similar and either played them for a baby over Zoom by a stranger, or had a toy sing it when you press a button, or had a parent sing it to them live and in person, and then waited many months and then came back to these babies and played these songs. And babies only got excited and were specially attentive to the music if it had months ago been sung to them by a parent in person. So they're very attuned to music as an index of people that they care about.
Interesting. So it's not just imagination. It's memory, even in an infant.
Exactly. And I think that's what we see through these imaginings, is that, you know, music serves kind of as a sticky paper, like you might put up to catch flies or something. And just as you go through your life, all these kinds of sonic patterns are accruing all these sorts of associations and contexts. And the end effect of this is you can hear something you've never heard before, and it activates all these patterns from categories of music you have previously heard that end up shaping something that feels very new, but deeply depends on memory.
Do you ever worry with your studies and with your book, Transported, the Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams, that you are uncovering something that sometimes might be better implemented in ingenuity in just the natural process?
I hear you. Yeah, I love that question. And in fact, there's nothing in the book, Transported, that is going to explain away or make less interesting any of your musical experiences. It's absolutely intended, and I think does make us more curious about them, help us see what can be learned and discovered by paying attention to them and talking about them and sharing them with others. So the response that I've tended to get is, I'll never listen to music the same way again, but in a way where it's richer and more interesting, not that it has been flattened or explained away.
In children, if you are playing music to children, do you get a sense as to what they can become or what they can do, or whether they're even musical because of the way they acclimate music?
So one of the qualities that's a pretty interesting kind of trait level difference than people can have around music that doesn't have to do with formal training at all is simply susceptibility to being absorbed by music. So how easy it is for you to hear something and just feel completely immersed in it, gripped by it, interested in it. And we see this difference in kids, and then we see that playing out across the lifespan. So think of your friends who spend all their time, you know, finding the coolest bands that are coming to town and like curating extensive playlists versus friends who really could kind of take or leave and they don't really mind what's on the stereo. And so there is that really reliable kind of individual difference just around how connected people feel to music.
I've noticed, particularly with little boys, and I was one of those myself, that little boys seem to have their own theme music when they're playing or when they're pretending to fight or whatever the case may be. Is that part of what transports them?
Absolutely. So this makes me think of my own 11-year-old who will do his chores. Like he will put the dishes away in the morning, but if and only if AC/DC is playing really loud on the speakers in the kitchen. So I think he's adopted that as his own personal dish doing hero music. And, you know, it was a lot for me to adapt to that much AC/DC every morning, but you know, it does seem to be important to him feeling like he can do what he needs to do.
It's a fascinating topic. The book is called Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. Elizabeth, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Margulis, author of Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0875, and you'll find links to Elizabeth's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
Did you hear about the boat that crashed that was carrying blue and red paint? It left the whole crew marooned.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
That's it for another shift. She's leaving work. Someone says, we're going for some food. Want to come? No thanks, she says. There's somewhere I need to go. Then she also goes for some food. At a food bank. 1 in 5 Canadian food bank visitors is working. Yet a job is still not enough. Visit the food bank near you to help and be helped.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of The Bigfoot Case, plus Mark Hartzman, the curator from WeirdHistorian.com, is back with his monthly visit talking about the Hollow Earth cult. We also have a Sir Dudley Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course an idiot of the day, and much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. The possums Michael Cove and AJ Sanjar trap, collar, and release might die. But Jeremy Dixon, who manages Crocodile Lake National Wildlife Refuge in Key Largo, Florida, says the biologists are not to blame. The duo says, harm's way is there. We're just documenting what's happening. The possums get names like Possum Razzie and Fudge Brownie, and they're fitted with collars that transmit radio signals if they stop moving for 6 hours. That lets the scientists investigate whether the marsupials are being consumed by invasive Burmese pythons, and if that's what happened, they go out and kill the pythons. And that protects endangered mice and wood rats that the snakes also eat. You know, it must be comforting for a possum that's being killed to know that it will be avenged. I also guess that from the python's point of view, they just ate a Trojan possum. 34-year-old Richard Carpenter was arrested May 4th for droning while intoxicated after allegedly using his drone to repeatedly buzz a delivery driver's parked car near his St. Petersburg, Florida apartment complex at around 12:20 a.m. Police say the unnamed aircraft flew back and forth past the open driver's window of John Murray's Infiniti sedan with spinning blades that could cause significant injury. Carpenter told officers he thought the victim was following him because he'd seen Murray's vehicle in multiple locations, not realizing Murray works as a delivery driver. Officers noted Carpenter smelled of alcohol and showed impairment signs, including slurred speech and glassy eyes. He admitted drinking before the incident. Carpenter also allegedly reached into Murray's car, grabbed his phone, and struck him near the left eye, resulting in burglary charges. He posted $150,500 bond and was released. Well, we're definitely reaching modern times when you can be charged for using a drone while impaired. The owner of a New Hampshire mustard company will spend time behind bars after a court determined the company secretly pumped pollutants into a river. 60-year-old Charles Santich, who owns the Old Dutch Mustard Company in Greenville, New Hampshire, was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The company will pay a $1.5 million fine for violating the Clean Water Act. Prosecutors say the company has had a long history of non-compliance with regulations beginning in the 1980s. Employees were ordered to do it or risk losing their jobs. It happened for 6 years, and the state attorney general said Santich submitted false documents to cover up what was happening. The court agreed with experts that the wastewater pumped into the river caused environmental harm and likely caused a mercury fish consumption advisory in the area of the discharges. Again, the headline, condiment company that dumped pollutants into river, has it catch up to them.
Greetings, passengers, to another Stuff File program installment of Idiots in Flight. This is the pre-boarding announcement. We are now inviting those passengers who are complete half-wits to begin boarding at this time. Thank you.
A flight heading from Melbourne, Australia to the United States was diverted in Tahiti after a passenger was reported to have allegedly bitten a flight attendant. Qantas flight QF21 between Melbourne and Dallas was diverted May 15th due to a disruptive passenger on board. The passenger allegedly bit the crew member, and fellow passengers helped to restrain him. Local authorities in Tahiti met the plane on its arrival in Papeete. Qantas said the passenger had been issued with a no-flight ban on the company's planes, said a Qantas spokesperson. The safety of our customers and our crew is our number one priority, and we have zero tolerance for disruptive or threatening behavior on our flights. The plane was refueled and resumed its journey, with the rest of the passengers arriving in Dallas the following morning. You know, while you're in Australia, you can be bitten by several creatures, but I'm sure no one thought about a fellow passenger on a Qantas flight.
Here's a warning to some passengers. The air marshals are getting creative. For most of the flight, you might have zip-tied limbs and you may be duct-taped in an overhead bin until your diverted destination. But the Stuff File program appreciates you. Thank you.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
The bottle of perfume that Willie sent was highly displeasing to Millicent. Her thanks were so cold, they quarreled, I'm told, through that silly scent Willie sent Millicent.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? S.A. Schneider is an acclaimed children's author. He has just released the first book in the Oddish Quester series. The title of it is The Bigfoot Case. He joins us from Ohio via Riverside.com. Hi there.
Hey, hi, how you doing? And I appreciate you getting it correct. A lot of people say Oddish Questions. And I'm like, no, they do ask some questions, but that's not the title. It's Oddish Questers.
And what exactly is, for you, Oddish Questers?
It's a great name, I think, don't you? It makes you go, what the heck is that? But it's me taking words and trying to find a unique word that means the same thing. So it's basically the X-Files, but more modern. Think of it kind of like if you were looking for a show or a book or something that was a combination of the X-Files and Scooby-Doo's, that's what Oddish Questers does. And that's kind of where I came up with it, kind of just brainstorming and put several interesting words together that all meant, you know, looking for interesting and strange things.
As a children's author, do you write for all ranges and age groups of children? And what is this particular series aimed at as far as age is concerned?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't get to ask that half enough. So just like Harry Potter was a kid's book that every adult read, this is similar. I don't want to call it YA because YA has a certain feel to the genre and certain tropes, certain things that people look for, just like, you know, romantic fantasy and things like that. So it is, I guess, close to the style of a Harry Potter book in that kids can read it 12 and up, but I've gotten great feedback from many adults. I tried to do kind of a Bugs Bunny thing where the kids can read it and laugh and enjoy the stuff, but if you're an adult and you read it, there's some jokes in there that are even funnier for you without getting anything that would, you know, change it out of a general G rating.
Got you. Now, I'm looking at the press release and there's an odd sentence here. It says, when cryptid investigator Taylor vanishes. Now, I'm curious, is Taylor an investigator of cryptids or is Taylor a cryptid?
No, he investigates cryptids. He's on a team that is looking at some strange reports that people have sent in. And it's kind of based on some real investigators that I know.
Really?
Yes. In fact, in the book, there's a gentleman by the name of Stan Gordon, a character in the book. He's actually a real person, and he allowed me to fictionalize him for the book. He just said that, you know, make sure everybody knows this is not a real documented report, that this is fiction, because he does take documented reports. He's been doing so since the 60s. He's been on multiple TV shows, multiple books, multiple articles, interviews, everything. So he's fairly well known within the community and to a lot of people outside. If you watch any type of shows that have anybody from the Pennsylvania region talking about Bigfoot and UFOs, he's probably in there. So, you know, I tried to base the book, you know, like Michael Crichton taking science theories and turning them into fiction. That was what I was trying to do with this.
What is the Bigfoot case about?
It has nothing to do with Bigfoot. No. It's everything about Bigfoot. So the Oddish Questers are a teen sibling group that hunt cryptids like Bigfoot, Mothman, Chupacabra. And the book starts off, as you read, with an investigator going missing and they get called into the case. And their goal is to find Taylor. There's some skepticism within the group that Bigfoot really exists. They get some clues that lead them to some interesting discoveries. And the whole race is to try and find Taylor. And there's some theories on what Bigfoot is and how Bigfoot exists that I wove into the story. That's not your typical, you know, he's a big ape running around in the woods. There's some newer, I guess not newer, but there's some more out there theories, you might say, that I tried to use within the book. Again, all based on real reports.
Interesting concept. I don't want you to give anything away, but you know, when it comes to Bigfoot, the one thing that I'm always questioning is the fact that in this day and age, with everyone having a cell phone that takes pictures and everyone else has a camera, why do we still have those ancient grainy pictures of Bigfoot? There's nothing new.
True. I do live in an area of Ohio where last month there was a huge rash of sightings. But it got questionable because there were no pictures. Lots of people said they saw something. And one lady even said, oh, I was standing by the sink for 30 seconds and watching them. And everybody's like, and you didn't grab your camera? So yeah, that's a good question. And let me just say, I don't have answers, but I do like some of the theories that involve quantum physics and quantum entanglement and wormholes and things like that. Again, there are science theories that have been coming up within the Bigfoot community to explain certain things. And, you know, maybe that's the direction we need to go. At least the Oddish Questers, that's the direction they went.
I've been looking at your bio, and so you probably know what I'm going to ask next. You yeah. have a wolf, and I just need to ask, why?
Actually, what I tell people is, and the kids love this, that I'm a terrible writer, and I don't come up with any ideas, but Hunter, that's my wolf, he has the best stories, but he can't hold a pencil, so he has to wait for me to actually write all these stories down. I do have a wolf. He's, my muse. He's a great boy. I actually have him as a character in the book. He basically told me if I'm going to use all his ideas and claim them as my own stories, I better make him a good character. So he's in the book.
How does one get a wolf?
He is a rescue. He's a hybrid. So he's 75% Sarlouze wolf. We don't actually know everything about him because we got him when he was two. There was a wolf rescue, and they got him from somebody that had him. They were going to put him down because he has a problem with one of his paws, his genetic disorder, but we rescued him, and he's been living with us since. He's a happy boy. He's very lovable. Love his coat of fur. He's got wonderful coat of fur. He's friendly. You know, all the things we hear about the big bad wolf are not true. He's very protective of the family. I will say that. And you don't want to walk up and try and take a bone from him. But other than that, he's a great, loving animal, great part of the family. And in the book, he's part of the Oddish Questers. He's part of the group.
Well, let's get back to the book. This is the first book in the Oddish Questers series. How many do you anticipate that you're going to be doing? And would you like to see it either on the big screen or small screen, either in an animation or in live action?
Well, would you believe anybody that said, no, I don't want it to be TV or movies? But I'm glad you asked it that way, because honestly, I would love to have a cartoon of these guys. I'd love to have kids, you know, like Scooby-Doo used to be for me, watching these adventures. And I think it would fit so perfectly. And even better, we could do it in like the Star Wars Visions, where it's different animators and storytellers doing it different styles and ways. But yes, there are quite a few planned. These stories started off as short stories that I wrote for my kids and stepkids for Christmas. And now I'm turning them into longer stories. I've got two I'm working on, and a third idea along, and those aren't even the sequel to book one. I got a friend who wrote a book about the Monroeville Monster that he took off the market, and I bought the license from him, and I'm turning it into giving it the Princess Bride type of treatment. I'm having my characters discover the book, and so when you're reading the book, there's interjections from my characters, but I took my friend's book story and put it together like that. So there's some fun things. I've got a choose your own adventure I'm working on. I want to release for Halloween this year. So a lot of things coming with that. I've got more stories than I can probably get out in the next 2 or 3 years.
when and why did the writing bug come your way, and why for young people?
This was years ago, when I was a Girl Scout leader for my daughter's Girl Scout troop, all the girls read, which was great, but I noticed that they were all reading books with male protagonists. And I said, you know what? Somebody should do something about that. Somebody should write a book that has a girl protagonist that's the hero and all of that. And of course, then I drugged my feet. And in the meantime, lots of books started coming out focusing on girls and for girls. So I kind of missed that little opportunity. But as my kids got older, it didn't leave me, and I still had story ideas I wanted to get out. So now that the kids are gone, that's what I get to do, is get all these stories written out.
Well, congratulations on the Bigfoot case, and many more to come after that. And thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. It's nice. Fun.
S.A. Schneider, author of The Bigfoot Case, the first book in the Oddish Quester series. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0875, and you'll find the link to his site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about, this is Morning Shower Thoughts.
If you're someone who dreams in color, does that mean it's a pigment of your imagination?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Here are two of the many glowing reviews that Michael Libling has received for his novel, The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. Arabella Magazine says,
I couldn't put it down. I want more books like this, and I want more books written by Michael Libling.
Best-selling author Nicholas Kaufman says,
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife is sharp, funny, thrilling, and endlessly original.
The only unsolved mystery here is why you haven't read it yet. The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife is available wherever you find books.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Now, the Stuff File program presents The Weird Story of the Month with Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com.
And here we are with the weird historical story for the month of May. And Mark, this is a story where a cult thought that they could live in the earth, which was hollowed out. But to no one's surprise, it was only their heads that were hollow.
Yeah, you might say that. And it wasn't that they thought the earth itself was hollowed out and that there was this exterior that we live on. That's another hollow earth theory. We can talk about that too. They thought that we were on the surface as we are now, and that was inside of a hollow earth. So the sky itself was part of this sphere that we were living inside, and that the sun was revolving within this sphere, and that the moon was basically like a reflection of something in the middle of the earth, and it wasn't actually another celestial body out there, and that this sphere, with the sky being at like the surrounding top of the sphere, was it. So about 25,000 miles in circumference, so about 8,000 miles across, that was the universe. There was nothing outside of it. And just for a little perspective, this cult started by a man named Cyrus Teed in 1893, called the Koreshans. You know, started late, you know, like I said, 1893. So this was before anyone actually left the earth, flew in the sky and discovered space discovered space. You know what I mean? Like actually flew into space. These were interesting times. And I guess they thought that maybe they felt some comfort knowing that there was nothing else out there. And it was just this small little sphere that we lived inside. So this particular story is from May of 1927. One of the cult members had been basically shipped away from the cult, put on a train, and sent to an insane asylum. And he complained that he was sent to the insane asylum because he had been incapacitated, he'd been injured, and was unable to work. And so they got rid of him. And basically everyone there had different jobs. They kind of had their own society. They built up, you know, the markets and a printing press, and they had roads. They basically were their own little society, these people living within this Hollow Earth cult. And so this man, George Sanders, was upset that he was sent to the insane asylum, and he complained about the guys who sent him there and, you know, accused him of sending members out of the colony just for getting hurt and being unable to work. So after that, a couple of the guys from the cult, as I mentioned, they had a printing press, they had their own newspaper, and they printed that this guy was crazy for saying that. And so that got Sanders upset even more. So he filed a libel suit against them for $250,000.
Which was a lot of money back in the 20s.
Yeah, yeah, it was. Exactly. You know, he was pretty upset by the whole thing. So like I said, this was reported in a bunch of newspapers that were not part of the cult. In fact, I love the headline of this particular one, which is sort of an understatement. The headline is Colony is Unusual. The subhead says Koreshans believe mankind inhabits Hollow Earth. But yeah, he looked for $250,000 in his libel suit. I was looking for some follow-up articles. I didn't find any, unfortunately. So I don't know if he got any money out of these guys or not. But this cult was in Florida, where lots of strange things happen, in a town called Estero, which was sort of southwest area of the state. And the members, just to give you a little more sense of them, besides believing in just that they lived in the Hollow Earth, they were very communal. Cyrus Teed believed that they should have no possessions. So if you joined the cult, you gave up all of your possessions. And he believed in celibacy. He thought that celibacy would bring about immortality. Saving all that energy would make you immortal. So men gave up their wives. The women had jobs just within the community, but there was no sex allowed in this community. And they just lived amongst themselves, worked, and hoped for immortality inside their Hollow Earth. And then, of course, they believed all this, of course, because they're in the cult, right? And Cyrus Teed said that he would rise from the dead. He ended up dying in 1923. He got beat up outside some of the a shop outside the cult. Some guys beat him up. And after, I guess, an encounter, those injuries eventually led to his death in 1923. So he was buried in Estero. His followers were waiting for him to arise from his grave, as he said he would. And then about a year later, a hurricane hit and washed away his whole tomb, and his body was never found. So as far as we know, he still hasn't risen.
Okay, so let me see if I get this straight. How crazy do you have to be for a cult to want to put you in an asylum?
Yeah, that's kind of what's really amusing about the whole thing. But basically, I think what they thought was that they're paying taxes to the state. So if they're paying taxes, that an asylum should be able to take in someone and care for them. And so that's just where they shipped them, just to get rid of him, because apparently, according to Sanders, he was unable to work anymore and therefore useless to the colony. So they just stuck him there. And he was obviously not happy about that.
Now, as you mentioned, they had to give up their wives. But you also said that there were women who were just workers, but not romantically involved with the men.
Right.
Were the women part of the cult? Were they allowed to be part of the cult?
Yeah. They were. In fact, they had some pretty good roles in the cults. They were editors, they were musicians, teachers, administrators. They helped run the printing presses. They helped in governing the whole settlement that they have. They made different sorts of crafts and went to the town and sold them to raise some money. So they definitely had a role. In fact, at that time, it may have actually been more roles than they could have gotten outside of the cult. But they just happened to have to live in a cult that believed that they lived in a Hollow Earth. So that was sort of a trade-off, I suppose.
Now, did any of the wives that weren't allowed to be intimate with their husbands, were any of the wives in this cult?
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah. I think they would join, and then they just had to give up their physical relationship with each other.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, cults do weird things.
I would assume, since no one's having any sexual relations, that there are no children involved. So I'm assuming that this cult, if not disbanded, just simply died out.
Yeah, you know, I think that's about right. In fact, this article mentions that Sanders said that the heads of the colony at this time, this again was 4 years after Teed had died, the founder, he said that this was the last generation and that these leaders were the youngest of that group and that they would probably inherit everything from the cult. But I did find a story about a woman who joined at least in the 40s. So it did carry on for a little bit longer. But yeah, I think eventually, unless new people were joining, you know, how long could it really go on? At a certain point also, you know, you did have the first man in space in the early 1900s. We did have, you know, obviously the Wright brothers. So science was starting to disprove, even though they had their own science that kind of justified their own logic of the 8,000 mile, I guess, diameter, you would say, of the Earth. Eventually, we other people proved that there was something more to this universe and that we clearly don't live in a hollow Earth.
I assume at some point people were dying off. They thought they were going to be immortal, but witness around them, people were dying off. So what did they think about that?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, they still believed the Teed would rise even after he was washed away. In fact, the article mentions it. It talks about his body was never found, but the faithful members still watch for his second appearance. But I don't know if they wondered the same thing when other people were dying, you know, or what their idea of immortality was like. If it was more in a spiritual sense or what it was. But yeah, clearly they weren't living forever and they must have discovered that at some point. So it does feel like a promise that eventually you realize isn't going to happen, unfortunately.
I'm sure that somebody in this particular group had some kind of money.
Yes.
That they had. And so whatever happened to that?
I don't know what exactly happened to all their money, but I do know that where they were living, that space in Estero has become the Crescent State Park now in Florida. So in that sense, it lives on.
And it it is in Florida, so.
Right, exactly. Here on our non-hollow Earth. Now, you mentioned at the beginning about living inside the Earth, and I mentioned we could talk more about that because there is the hollow Earth theory that others had, which was that the Earth that we live on has a hollow inside that people live in. So that was another weird belief. That started also in the early 1900s. There were people writing about that, and they thought that there were holes at the North and South Pole, and you could just go inside the hole, and you would find a whole other community living in there that were survivors of the Atlantis world, so that they were highly intelligent descendants of the Atlanteans. And this was, there was a book written in 1969 about this hollow Earth idea. And this was, you know, not long after the UFO craze started in 1947. And so they believed that all the UFOs that were being seen were coming from inside the Earth, not from another planet. Now I'm just kind of getting into a connection to what's been going on with the release of UFO files of the US government. another May connection, if you will. But they thought that UFOs were flying out of the Earth and were disturbed by the atomic age that started after World War II, and they were concerned that the inside of the Earth was going to get ruined by atomic weapons, nuclear weapons. So they were flying out to try to warn people that they should, you know, be careful with this power, watch out because you could destroy everything. But they wouldn't want to tell them that they lived inside the Earth, so they told them they were space people from other planets, because if they knew they were inside the Earth, then us Earthlings would go in there and we'd ruin everything. So this was another hollow Earth theory, not my theory.
Yeah. So nuclear proliferation is a danger, but for these people, for an entirely different reason.
Yes.
That's a weird story. Thank you once again, Mark.
Kind of two weird hollow Earth stories.
Two weird hollow Earth stories for the month of May. And a story that deals with Florida. So there you go. Anyway, Mark, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com and also the publisher at CuriousPublications.com. He's the author and curator of several books. His latest one is The Talking Dead, a collection of messages from beyond the veil, 1850s to 1920s. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0875, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. in just a matter of moments. But I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. The city of Westlake, Ohio, has an Are You OK program. Each day, participants get an automated phone call to check on them. If they don't answer, police escalate until there's a resolution. An unnamed 91-year-old woman didn't answer the call, so the police dispatcher tried a manual call. No answer. They called her daughter, who didn't get an answer either, so officers responded. Part of the program is to provide a code to get into the participant's home to help them if there's a medical emergency. When officers found her car was there, they let themselves in while calling out and found the woman. An officer radioed that, "We're here with her. She's playing video games in her bedroom." She explained that she ignored the phone calls because she was beating her record score. Said Police Captain Jerry Vogel, "Everyone got a good laugh out of it." Well, she's 91 years old, and clearly she still drives because her car was in the driveway. She shouldn't be in her bedroom playing video games. She should be out challenging gamers so she can fleece them all of their cash, because they won't suspect a 91-year-old woman that can smoke them all. Yeah. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
20-year-old Ryan Schaefer, a Missouri State University student, pleaded guilty to felony property damage for vandalizing 17 vehicles in a campus parking lot. The Springfield incident occurred during a 3 a.m. rampage where Schaefer shattered car windows, ripped off mirrors, dented hoods, and broke windshield wipers. Police discovered Schaefer had confessed to ChatGPT minutes after the vandalism, asking the AI program questions like, "How bleeped am I, and will I go to jail?" During the typo-filled conversation, Schaefer asked if the university had cameras in the parking lot and boasted about previous vandalism, writing, "I got away with it last year." The Class E felony carries 1 to 4 years in prison, though Schaefer could receive up to 1 year in county jail. His sentencing is scheduled for July 27th. Now, why, oh why, would you confess your crimes to ChatGPT? And come to think of it, why wouldn't you ask ChatGPT about university cameras in the parking lot before you attempted your crime spree? Well, one reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0875. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0875. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZCHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.